that's known as Hostess. So those are coming up right now. So sit back, relax, and enjoy some spoken word entertainment here with us on CITR 101.9 FM.
LGBTQ2I Night is a positive space for folks to learn about bike maintenance in a relaxed environment led by queer mechanics and volunteers. It takes place on the fourth Wednesday of every month at the Bike Kitchen on UBC's campus. Bring your own bike and fix them with our tools, come with questions and ask away, or learn by watching other folks work on their bikes. Beginners are always welcome. This event is entirely free to attend and there will be free pizza. For more information, visit bikecoop.ca.
Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction. Mindwebs this time comes to you in two parts. First, we do a story from the book Welcome to the Monkey House by Kurt Vonnegut Jr. A short tale entitled Harrison Bergeron. The year was 2081, and everybody was finally equal. They weren't only equal before God and the law, they were equal every which way. Nobody was smarter than anybody else. Nobody was better looking than anybody else. Nobody was stronger or quicker than anybody else. All this equality was due to the 211th, 212th, and 213th Amendments to the Constitution, and to the unceasing vigilance of agents of the United States Handicapper General. Some things about living still weren't quite right, though. April, for example, still drove people crazy by not being springtime. And it was in that clammy month that the HG men took George and Hazel Bergeron's 14-year-old son, Harrison, away. It was tragic, all right, but George and Hazel couldn't think about it very hard. Hazel had a perfectly average intelligence, which meant she couldn't think about anything except in short bursts. And George, while his intelligence was way above normal, had a little mental handicap radio in his ear. He was required by law to wear it at all times. It was tuned to a government transmitter. Every 20 seconds or so, the transmitter would send out some sharp noise to keep people like George from taking unfair advantage of their brains. George and Hazel were watching television. There were tears on Hazel's cheeks, but she'd forgotten for the moment what they were all about. On the television screen were ballerinas. A buzzer sounded in George's head. His thoughts fled in panic like bandits from a burglar alarm, and Hazel said,
"That was a real pretty dance, that dance they just did.
Huh?
That dance. It was nice."
Oh, yeah.
George tried to think a little about the ballerinas. They weren't really very good. No better than anybody else would have been, anyway. They were burdened with sash weights and bags of birdshot, and their faces were masked, so that no one seeing a free and graceful gesture or a pretty face would feel like something the cat drug in. George was toying with a vague notion that maybe dancers shouldn't be handicapped. But he didn't get very far with it before another noise in his ear radio scattered his thoughts. George winced. So did two out of the eight ballerinas. Hazel saw him wince. Having no mental handicap herself, she had to ask George what the latest sound had been.
It sounded like somebody hitting a milk bottle with a ball peen hammer.
I think it'd be real interesting hearing all the different sounds. All the things they think up. Only if I was the handicapper general, you know what I'd do?
Hazel, as a matter of fact, bore a strong resemblance to the handicapper general, a woman named Diana Moon Glampers.
If I was Diana Moon Glampers, I'd have chimes on Sunday. Just chimes. Kind of in honor of religion.
I could think if it was just chimes.
Well, maybe make them real loud. I think I'd make a good handicapper general.
Good as anybody else.
Who knows better than I do what normal is?
Right.
George began to think glimmeringly about his abnormal son, who was now in jail, about Harrison. But a 21-gun salute in his head stopped that.
Boy, that was a doozy, wasn't it?
It was such a doozy that George was white and trembling, and tears stood on the rims of his red eyes. Two of the 8 ballerinas had collapsed to the studio floor, were holding their temples.
All of a sudden, you look so tired. Why don't you stretch out on the sofa so as you can rest your handicap bag on the pillows, honey bunch?
She was referring to the 47 pounds of birdshot in a canvas bag that was padlocked around George's neck.
Go on and rest the bag for a little bit. I don't care if you're not equal to me for a while.
George weighed the bag with his hands.
I don't mind it. I don't notice it anymore. It's just a part of me.
Oh, you've been so tired lately, kind of wore out. Oh, if there was just some way we could make a little hole in the bottom of the bag and just take out a few of them lead balls. Just a few.
2 years in prison and $2,000 fine for every ball I took out? I don't call that a bargain.
Well, if you could just take a few out when you come home from work. I mean, you don't compete with anybody around here. You just sit around.
If I tried to get away with it, then other people would get away with it. And pretty soon we'd be right back to the Dark Ages again. With everybody competing against everybody else. Now, you wouldn't like that, would you?
I'd hate it.
Well, there you are. The minute people start cheating on laws, what do you think happens to society?
If Hazel hadn't been able to come up with an answer to this question, George couldn't have supplied one. A siren going off in his head.
I reckon it'd fall apart.
What would?
Society. Oh, wasn't that what you just said?
Who knows?
The television program was suddenly interrupted for a news bulletin. It wasn't clear at first as to what the bulletin was about, since the announcer, like all announcers, had a serious speech impediment. For about half a minute, and in a state of high excitement, the announcer tried to say the words. He finally gave up and handed the bulletin to the ballerina.
That's all right. He tried. That's the big thing. He tried to do the best he could with what God gave him. He should get a nice raise for trying so hard.
Ladies and gentlemen,
said the ballerina, reading the bulletin. She must have been extraordinarily beautiful because the mask she wore was hideous. And it was easy to see that she was the strongest and most graceful of all the dancers. For her handicap bags were as big as those worn by 200-pound men. And she had to apologize at once for her voice, which was a very unfair voice for a woman to use. Her voice was a warm, luminous, timeless melody.
Excuse me,
she said, and began again, making her voice absolutely uncompetitive.
Harrison Bergeron, age 14, has just escaped from jail, where he was held on suspicion of plotting to overthrow the government. He is a genius, and an athlete is under-handicapped and should be regarded as extremely dangerous.
A police photograph of Harrison Bergeron was flashed on the screen upside down, then sideways, upside down again, then right side up. The picture showed the full length of Harrison against a background calibrated in feet and inches. He was exactly 7 feet tall. The rest of Harrison's appearance was Halloween and hardware. Nobody had ever worn heavier handicaps. He had outgrown hindrances faster than the HG men could think them up. Instead of a little ear radio for a mental handicap, he wore a tremendous pair of earphones and spectacles with thick, wavy lenses. The spectacles were intended to make him not only half blind, but to give him wanging headaches besides. Scrap metal was hung all over him, Ordinarily, there was a certain symmetry, a military neatness to the handicaps issued to strong people. But Harrison looked like a walking junkyard. In the race of life, Harrison carried 300 pounds. And to offset his good looks, the HG men required that he wear at all times a red rubber ball for a nose, keep his eyebrows shaved off, and cover his even white teeth with black caps at snaggletooth random.
If you see this boy, do not, I repeat, do not try to reason with him.
There was a shriek of a door being torn from its hinges. Screams and barking cries of consternation came from the television set. The photograph of Harrison Bergeron on the screen jumped again and again as though dancing to the tune of an earthquake. George Bergeron correctly identified the earthquake, as well he might have, for many was the time his own home had danced to the same crashing tune.
My God, that must be Harrison.
The realization was blasted from his mind instantly by the sound of an automobile collision in his head. When George could open his eyes again, the photograph of Harrison was gone. A living, breathing Harrison filled the screen. Clanking, clownish, huge, Harrison stood in the center of the studio, the knob of the uprooted studio door still in his hand. Ballerinas, technicians, musicians, announcers all cowered on their knees before him, expecting to die.
I am the Emperor. Do you hear? I am the Emperor. Everybody must do what I say at once.
Harrison stamped his foot and the studio shook. He bellowed,
even as I stand here, crippled, hobbled, sickened, I am a greater ruler than any man who has ever lived. Now, watch me become what I can become.
Harrison tore the straps of his handicap harness like wet tissue paper. Tore straps guaranteed to support 5,000 pounds. Harrison's scrap iron handicaps crashed to the floor, and Harrison thrust his thumbs under the bar of the padlock that secured his head harness. The bar snapped like celery. Harrison smashed his headphones and spectacles against the wall. He flung away his rubber ball nose, revealed a man that would have awed Thor, the god of thunder.
I shall now select my empress. Let the first woman who dares rise to her feet claim her mate and her throne.
A moment passed, and then a ballerina arose, swaying like a willow. Harrison plucked the mental handicap from her ear, snapped off her physical handicaps with marvelous delicacy. Last of all, he removed her mask. She was blindingly beautiful. Taking her hand, he said,
now, shall we show the people the meaning of the word dance? Music!
The musicians scrambled back into their chairs, and Harrison stripped them of their handicaps, too.
Play your best, and I'll make you barons and dukes and earls!
The music began. It was normal at first, cheap, silly, false. But Harrison snatched two musicians from their chairs, waved them like batons as he sang the music as he wanted it played. He slammed them back into their chairs. The music began again and was much improved. Harrison and his empress merely listened to the music for a while, listened gravely, as though synchronizing their heartbeats with it. They shifted their weights to their toes, and Harrison placed his big hands on the girl's tiny waist, letting her sense the weightlessness that would soon be hers. And then, in an explosion of joy and grace, into the air they sprang. Not only were the laws of the land abandoned, but the law of gravity and the laws of motion as well. They reeled, whirled, swiveled, flounced, capered, gambled, and spun. They leaped like deer on the moon. The studio ceiling was 30 feet high, but each leap brought the dancers nearer to it. It became their obvious intention to kiss the ceiling. They kissed it. And then, neutralizing gravity with love and pure will, they remained suspended in air inches below the ceiling. And they kissed each other for a long, long time. It was then that Diana Moon Glampers, the handicapper general, came into the studio with a double-barreled 10-gauge shotgun. She fired twice, and the Emperor and the Empress were dead before they hit the floor. Diana Moon Glampers loaded the gun again. She aimed it at the musicians and told them they had 10 seconds to get their handicaps back on. It was then the Bergeron's television tube burned out. Hazel turned to comment about the blackout to George, but George had gone out into the kitchen for a can of beer. George came back in with the beer, paused while a handicap signal shook him up, and then he sat down again and said to Hazel,
"You've been crying?"
"Yep."
"What about?"
"Well, I forget. Something real sad on television."
"What was it?"
"It's all kind of mixed up in my mind."
"Forget sad things."
"I always do."
"That's my girl."
George winced. There was the sound of a riveting gun in his head.
"Gee, I could tell that one was a doozy."
"Oh, you can say that again."
"Gee, I could tell that one was a doozy."
The second story tonight is called The Haunted Spacesuit by Arthur C. Clarke. It's from the book 50 Short Science Fiction Tales, edited by Isaac Asimov and Groff Conklin. When Satellite Control called me, I was writing up the day's progress report in the observation bubble, the glass-domed office that juts out from the axis of the space station like the hubcap of a wheel. It was not really a good place to work, for the view was too overwhelming. Only a few yards away, I could see the construction teams performing their slow-motion ballet as they put the station together like a giant jigsaw puzzle. And beyond them, 20,000 miles below, was the blue-green glory of the full Earth, floating against the raveled star clouds. "Station supervisor here," I answered. "What's the trouble?" "Our radar is showing a small echo 2 miles away, almost stationary, about 5 miles west of Sirius. Can you give us a visual report on it?" Now, anything matching our orbit so precisely could hardly be a meteor. It would have to be something we dropped, perhaps an inadequately secured piece of equipment that had drifted away from the station. So I assumed. But when I pulled out my binoculars and searched the sky around Orion, I soon found my mistake. Though this space traveler was man-made, it had nothing to do with us. "I've found it," I told Control. "It's someone's test satellite, cone-shaped, four antennas, probably U.S. Air Force, early 1960s, judging by the design. I know they lost track of several when their transmitters failed. There were quite a few attempts to hit this orbit before they finally made it." Well, after a brief search through the files, Control was able to confirm my guess. It took a little longer to find that now, in 1988, Washington wasn't in the least bit interested in our discovery, and would be just as happy if we lost it again. And they said, "Well, we can't do that. Even if nobody wants it, the thing's a menace to navigation. Someone had better go out and haul it aboard, get it out of orbit." That someone, I realized, would have to be me. I dared not detach a man from the closely knit construction teams. We were already behind schedule. And a single day's delay on this job cost $1 million. All the radio and TV networks on Earth were waiting impatiently for the moment when they could route their programs through us and thus provide the first truly global service spanning the world from pole to pole. "Well, I'll go out and get it," I answered, Control. Though I tried to sound as if I were doing everyone a great favor, I was secretly not at all displeased. It had been at least 2 weeks since I'd been outside. The only member of the staff I passed on my way to the airlock was Tommy, our recently acquired cat. Pets mean a great deal to men thousands of miles from Earth, but there are not very many animals that can adapt themselves to a weightless environment. Tommy mewed plaintively at me as I clambered into my spacesuit, but I was in too much of a hurry to play with him. At this point, I should perhaps remind you that the suits we use on the station are completely different from the flexible affairs men wear when they want to walk around the moon. Ours are really baby space ships, just about big enough to hold one man. They're stubby cylinders about 7 feet long, fitted with low-powered propulsion jets.
They have a pair of accordion-like sleeves at the upper end for the operator's arms. As soon as I'd settled down inside my very exclusive spacecraft, I switched on power and checked the gauges on the tiny instrument panel. All my needles were well in the safety zone, so I gave Tommy a wink for luck, lowered the transparent hemisphere over my head, and sealed myself in. For a short trip like this, I didn't bother to check the suit's internal lockers, which were used to carry food and special equipment for extended missions. As the conveyor belt decanted me into the airlock, I felt like an Indian papoose being carried along on its mother's back. Then the pumps brought the pressure down to zero, the outer door opened, and the last traces of air swept me out into the stars, turning very slowly head over heels. The station was only a dozen feet away, yet I was now an independent planet, a little world of my own. I was sealed up in a tiny mobile cylinder with a superb view of the entire universe. But I had practically no freedom of movement inside the suit. The padded seat and safety belts prevented me from turning around, though I could reach all the controls and lockers with my hands or with my feet. In space, the great enemy is the sun, which can blast you to blindness in seconds. So very cautiously, I opened up the dark filters on the night side of my suit and then turned my head to look out at the stars. At the same time, I switched the helmet's external sunshade to automatic, so that whichever way the suit gyrated, my eyes would be shielded. Presently, I found my target, a bright fleck of silver whose metallic glint distinguished it clearly from the surrounding stars. I stamped on the jet control pedal and felt a mild surge of acceleration as the low-powered rocket set me moving away from the station. After 10 seconds of steady thrust, I cut off the drive. It would take me 5 minutes to coast the rest of the way, and not much longer to return to my salvage. It was at that moment, as I launched myself out into the abyss, that I knew that something was horribly wrong. It's never completely silent inside a spacesuit. You can always hear the gentle hiss of oxygen, the faint whir of fans and motors, the susurration of your own breathing. Even if you listen carefully enough, the rhythmic thump that's the pounding of your heart. These sounds reverberate through the suit, unable to escape into the surrounding void. They're the unnoticed background of life in space. For you are aware of them only when they change. Well, they had changed now. To them had been added a sound which I could not identify. It was an intermittent, muffled sort of thudding, sometimes accompanied by a scraping noise. I froze instantly, holding my breath and trying to locate the alien sound with my ears. The meters on the control board gave no clues. All the needles were rock steady on their scales, and there were none of the flickering red lights that would warn of impending disaster. That was some comfort, but not much. I had long ago learned to trust my instincts in such matters. It was their alarm signals that were flashing now, telling me to return to the station before it was too late. Well, even now, I do not like to recall those next few minutes, as panic slowly flooded into my mind like a rising tide, overwhelming the dikes of reason and logic that every man must erect against the mystery of the universe. I knew then what it was to face insanity. No other explanation fitted the facts. For it was no longer possible to pretend that the noise disturbing me was that of some faulty mechanism. Though I was in utter isolation, far from any other human being or indeed any material object, I was not alone. The soundless void was bringing to my ears the faint but unmistakable stirrings of life. In that first heart-freezing moment, it seemed that something was trying to get into my suit, something invisible, seeking shelter from the cruel and pitiless vacuum of space. I whirled madly in my harness, scanning the entire sphere of vision around me except for the blazing forbidden cone towards the sun. There was nothing there, of course. There could not be, yet that purposeful scrabbling was clearer.
than ever.
Despite the nonsense that has been written about us, it's not true that spacemen are superstitious. But can you blame me if, as I came to the end of logic's resources, I suddenly remembered how Bernie Summers had died no further from the station than I was at this very moment? It was one of those impossible accidents. It always is. Three things had gone wrong at once. Bernie's oxygen regulator had run wild and sent the pressure soaring. The safety valve had failed to blow, and a faulty joint had given way. In a fraction of a second, his suit was open to space. I had never known Bernie, but suddenly his fate became of overwhelming importance to me, for a horrible idea had come into my mind. One does not talk about these things, but a damaged spacesuit is too valuable to be thrown away, even if it has killed its wearer. It's repaired, it's renumbered, and then issued to someone else. What happens to the soul of a man who dies between the stars, far from his native world? Were you still here, Bernie, clinging to that last object that linked you to your lost and distant home? As I fought the nightmares that were swirling around me, for now it seemed that the scratchings and soft fumblings were coming from all directions, there was one last hope to which I clung. For the sake of sanity, I had to prove that this wasn't Bernie's suit, that the metal wall so closely wrapped around me had never been another man's coffin. It took me several tries before I could press the right button and switch my transmitter to the emergency wavelength. Station, I called. I'm in trouble. Get records, dude. Check my suit. I never finished. They say my yell wrecked the microphone. But what man alone in the absolute isolation of space would not have yelled when something patted him softly on the back of the neck? I must have lunged forward despite the safety harness and smashed against the upper edge of the control panel. When the rescue squad reached me a few minutes later, I was still unconscious with an angry bruise across my forehead. And so I was the last person in the whole satellite relay system to know what had happened. When I came to my senses an hour later, all our medical staff was gathered around my bed, but it was quite a while before the doctors, and certainly the cute little space nurse, bothered to look at me. They were much too busy playing with the three little kittens that our badly misnamed Tommy had been rearing in my spacesuit's number three storage locker.
Looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
To my eyes, the last Sunday of every month from 11 to 5, won't you hear with me at the Wise Hall, please? Wise Hall, please.
Tonight, Hostess by Isaac Asimov.
I
I was so happy about it when I came home, almost triumphant. I dashed in the front door, peeled off my gloves, threw my hat on the side table, and tossed my coat over the back of a chair.
Well, you missed supper.
Drake, we're going to have him here.
Who here? What are you talking about?
The doctor from Hawkins Planet. Didn't you realize that was what today's conference was about?
When you say the doctor from Hawkins Planet, do you mean the Hawkinsite you've got at the Institute?
Well, of course. Who else could I possibly mean?
May I ask what the devil you mean by saying we'll have him here?
Darling, the Hawkinsite would like to stay at a private house somewhere where he won't be bothered with official ceremony, where he'll be able to proceed more according to his own likes and dislikes. I find it quite understandable.
Well, whenever you start using formal sentences, I know you're hiding extreme irritation.
Well, you don't seem to be trying to hide it at all. Well, what's the matter?
Look, I don't see where we've got room for extraterrestrial visitors.
Are you serious? He can stay in the spare room. Honestly, Drake, all we have to do is show a certain amount of adaptability.
Sure, just a little adaptability. The Hawkinsite breathes cyanide. We'll just adapt ourselves to that, I suppose.
He carries cyanide in a little cylinder. You won't even notice it.
Mm-hmm. And what else is there about them I won't notice?
Nothing else. They're perfectly harmless. They're even vegetarians.
But what about us? Do we eat meat ourselves? Or will that make us look like cannibals to him? I won't live on salads to suit him, I warn you.
Drake, it means very much to me.
Well, why?
Because if he stays here for any length of time, I can study him real closely. Very little work has been done on the biology and psychology of the individual Hawkinsite or of any of the extraterrestrial intelligences. Surely you must see the opportunity. He stays here. We speak to him, watch him, observe his habits.
Look, I've spoken to men who are in charge of security groups watching various Hawkinsite missions on Earth. The missions stay in the rooms assigned to them. They don't leave for anything but the most important official business. They have nothing to do with Earthmen. It's quite obvious that they're as revolted by us as I personally am by them.
Drake, he's a doctor. He's coming here for medical research, and I'll grant you that he probably doesn't enjoy staying with human beings and will probably find us perfectly horrible. But he must stay just the same.
All right. Have it your own way. You sure you don't want any coffee?
No. Drake, you're not angry about this, are you?
No, I'm not angry.
Most of my friends had been surprised when I married Drake because they couldn't understand my marrying a policeman. I explained he wasn't simply a policeman. He was a member of the World Security Board, but most of the staff at the Institute thought it rather odd that I hadn't married a biologist or at least an anthropologist, even a chemist, but certainly not a policeman. I was waiting for Drake with some apprehension that evening as I sat in the living room. Hark Tolan, the Hawkinsite, was standing quietly in the middle of the room. He was not sitting since he was not anatomically constructed to sit. He stood on two sets of limbs placed close together, while a third pair, entirely different in their construction, were suspended from a region that would have been the upper chest in the human being. His skin was hard, glistening, and ridged, and his face wore a distant resemblance to something alienly bovine.
Mrs. Smollett, you must forgive my English. The construction of my mouth, combined with the absence of incisors and canine teeth, is an obstacle to clear speech.
I think you speak very well.
Thank you.
My husband will be home soon, and then we'll eat.
Your husband?
Well, husband? Yes, you know. Mr. Smollett.
Ah, male. Of course. You must forgive me, Mrs. Smollett. Perhaps the greatest source of confusion among the five known races of the galaxy lies in the differences among them in regard to their sex life and the social institutions that grow around it.
I understand that.
The concept of husband and wife, for instance, exists only on Earth. I can achieve a sort of intellectual understanding of what that means, never an emotional one.
Dr. Tolan, I've consulted the Institute in preparing a menu, and I trust you'll find nothing in it that will upset you. Drake, is that you?
Yeah.
I'm in the living room, dear.
I suppose he's all delivered, complete.
Drake, this is Dr. Hark Tolan of Hawkins Planet. Dr. Tolan, my husband.
Good evening, Dr. Tolan.
Mr. Smollett.
Would you care for a drink?
I'm not particularly thirsty.
On Earth, there is a custom of drinking liquids which have been fortified with ethyl alcohol. We find it stimulating.
Oh, yes. I'm afraid, then, that I must decline. Ethyl alcohol would interfere most unpleasantly with my metabolism.
Well, so it does to Earthmen, too. But I understand, Dr. Tolan. Would you object to my drinking?
Of course not.
Good. I need one. A stiff one.
He stood at the table. I tried not to look at him as he ate. His wide, lipless mouth split his face alarmingly as he ingested food, and in chewing, his large jaws moved from side to side. There was evidence of his ungulate ancestry. I found myself wondering whether he would chew his cud later, and then I was afraid that Drake would get the same idea and leave the table in disgust, but he was taking everything quite calmly.
I imagine, Dr. Tolan, that the cylinder at your side holds cyanide.
Quite so.
Pure cyanide?
I hope you are not considering possible danger. I know the gas is highly poisonous to you, and I do not need a great deal. None of it emerges, except when I actually suck at the tube, which is fixed at the corner of my mouth.
I see. And you really must have the gas to live?
Are you not a biologist, Mr. Smollett?
No, Dr. Tolan. It's merely a minor government official. My wife's friends call me a policeman. Tell me, what happens if you don't breathe cyanide? Do you just go like that?
Not quite. The absence of it would be equivalent to slow strangulation.
Mm-hmm.
It's also very painful, difficult to treat. I've done some research on the problem.
I find it difficult to keep thinking of you as a doctor.
I understand what you mean. I find it difficult to think of you as a policeman.
I gather that you're not here on a pleasure trip.
No. I intend to study this queer planet you call Earth.
Queer? In what way?
It's always amazing to me to find how little you Earthmen understand your own characteristics. There are 5 intelligent races in the galaxy. Over and over, it is you Earthmen, more than any of the others, who are unique. Your people are the only ones which find hydrogen cyanide poisonous. Yours is the only form of intelligent life which is carnivorous. Yours is the only form of life which has not developed from the grazing animal. And most interesting of all, yours is the only form of intelligent life known which stops growing upon reaching maturity.
Well, you don't look very large, Dr. Tolan. I should say that you're an inch taller than I, which would make you 6'2". Are you young, or are you just small on Hawkins planet?
Neither. We grow at a diminishing rate with the years, so that at my age it would take 15 years to grow an additional inch. But we never entirely stop. And, of course, as a consequence, we never entirely die.
Did you hear that, Rose?
I never knew that before.
You mean people on Hawkins planet are immortal?
No people are truly immortal. Few of us live more than several centuries of your time. Still, it is unpleasant to think that death may come involuntarily. It is something which to us is extremely horrible.
Oh, we're quite used to it.
You Earthmen live with the thought. We do not. This is why we are disturbed to find that the incidence of inhibition death has been increasing in recent years.
What is this inhibition death?
A pathological cessation of growth. It's a wasting disease. A tragic one. And absolutely incurable. It is fatal within a year.
What causes it?
Mr. Smollett, we know nothing about the cause of the disease.
Well, then why did you come to Earth to study it?
Because, again, Earthmen are unique. They are the only intelligent beings who are immune. The inhibition death affects all other races, while Earthmen are immune. Somewhere in the biochemistry of the Earthite, there is the secret of that immunity. How interesting it would be to find it.
Well, now, look here. You can't say that Earthmen are immune. From where I sit, it looks as if the incidence is 100%. All Earthmen stop growing, and all Earthmen die. We've all got the inhibition death.
Earthmen live up to 70 years after the cessation of growth. That is not death as we know it. Your equivalent disease is rather one of unrestrained growth. Cancer, you call it.
Drake was being pleasant to Dr. Tolan. I wasn't sure whether it was for my sake or for his own. Drake has never gone out of his way to please me. Sometimes when I'm gloomy, I look at him across the table and ask myself, Why did he marry me? And suddenly after dinner in the living room, Dr. Tolan asked a question which surprised me.
You are a policeman, Mr. Smollett?
Yes.
I wonder, could you show me through one of the police departments on your planet?
Well, I don't belong to a police department in exactly the way you imagine. However, I have some contacts in the New York City Department.
Would I be able to visit the Missing Persons Bureau?
Why are you interested in the Missing Persons Bureau?
Because there again, you are unique. There's no such thing as a missing person on our planet. We're always aware of each other's exact location, no matter where on the planet we might be.
Can you feel such awareness even now, on Earth?
You mean across space? No, I'm afraid not. But you see the importance of the matter. All the uniqueness of Earth should be linked. If the lack of this sense can be explained, perhaps the immunity to inhibition death can be also. Tell me truthfully, Mr. Smollett, if Mrs. Smollett were to leave this room and enter another without your having seen her do so, would you really not be aware of her location?
I really would not.
Amazing. Please do not be offended by the fact that I find it revolting as well.
Drake.
Yes, I'm awake.
Why were you talking about the inhibition death to Dr. Tolan?
I'm taking an interest in your work, Rose. You've always wanted me to take an interest.
I'd rather you weren't sarcastic.
Rose, I'm tired. I'll talk to you tomorrow.
No, right now.
I want no questions from you and no interference. You do your job and I'll do mine.
The nature of my job is open and known.
The nature of my job isn't, by definition, but I'll tell you this. Our six-legged friend is here in this house for some definite reason. You weren't picked as biologist in charge for any random reason. 2 days ago, he'd been inquiring about me at the commission. But that's my job, and I won't discuss it with you any further. Do you understand?
No. But I won't question you if you don't want me to.
All right, and go to sleep.
I lay stiffly on my back, and the minutes passed and the quarter hours. I was trying to fit the pieces together. One picture remained clear in my mind. It hovered over me mockingly. At the end of the evening, the Hawkinsite had turned to me just before he left the room.
Good night, Mrs. Smollett. You're a most charming hostess.
I wanted to giggle then. How could he call me a charming hostess? To him, I must have been a horror, a monstrosity with too few limbs and too narrow a face. But then I saw Drake. He turned white. For one instant, his eyes had burned with something that looked like terror. I'd never before known Drake to show fear of anything. And the picture of that instant of pure panic remained with me until all my thoughts finally sagged into the oblivion of sleep. I remember one question that nagged at me through the haze. Why did he marry me?
I found your missing persons bureau interesting in that the large majority of missing persons are males.
Oh, well, that's not mysterious, Dr. Tolan. You simply didn't realize the economic setup we have on Earth.
My wife is an example of the minority of women who are capable of making their own way in the world.
Would you call the Missing Persons Bureau of New York a fair sampling of such cases in the planet at large?
Yes, I should think so.
Is there then an economic explanation for the fact that since interstellar travel has been developed, the percentage of young males among the missing is more pronounced than ever?
Well, that's even less of a mystery than the other. Nowadays, a runaway can hop the nearest space freighter. They're always looking for crewmen. No questions asked.
It's almost always young men. Their first year of marriage?
Well, that's just the time a man's troubles seem the greatest. If he survives the first year, there's usually no need to disappear at all.
Would it offend you if I disconnected for a period of time?
Disconnected?
It's like sleep. Oh. I hope you haven't had too exhausting a day.
It's just that I've been absorbing so many new and unusual concepts that I feel a desire for a little disconnection.
Drake? Drake, we've been sitting here for 10 minutes. Aren't you going to speak to me?
About what?
Last night you said you'd speak to me tomorrow. Well, I'm ready now.
I thought it was agreed that you wouldn't question me about my business in this matter.
I think it's too late for that. I know too much about your business by now.
What? What do you mean?
Drake, let go of my arm.
What are you talking about?
Dr. Tolan thinks that Earth is spreading the inhibition death purposely. That's it, isn't it?
Where did you get that idea?
It's true, isn't it?
I want to know exactly why you say that. Don't play games with me, Rose. This is for Keith.
Why don't you ask Dr. Tolan? He's an outstanding worker in the field. I looked over his papers this afternoon.
And what are his theories about the origin of the disease? Try to remember, Rose.
I think he blames Earth, but I think he admits they know nothing about how the disease is spread.
Well, I'll find out about this right now.
Drake, what are you going to do? What's that?
It's my gun. I'm going to ask him a few questions.
He ran out of the bedroom, down the corridor, towards Dr. Tolan's room. I ran after him, caught him just as he entered the door. The Hawkinsite was standing there, motionless, his eyes unfocused, his four standing limbs sprawled out in four directions as far as they would go.
Now keep quiet. He'll gradually become aware of me. Get out of here.
No, Drake. What are you doing?
Quiet. There, you see? The skin on his face is beginning to quiver. Well, that's about all, Dr. Tolan. Don't throw in connection with any of the limbs. Your sense organs and the voice box will be quite enough.
Why do you invade my disconnection chamber? And why are you armed? What do you want?
The answer to certain questions.
With a gun in your hand? Sorry, Mr. Smollett, that the duties toward a guest are so badly understood on Earth.
You're no guest of mine, Dr. Tolan. You entered my home under false pretenses.
You had better shoot. It will save time.
You are convinced that you'll answer no questions? Now, that in itself is suspicious. It seems that you consider certain answers to be more important than your life.
I consider the principle of courtesy to be very important. You, as an Earthman, may not understand.
Perhaps not. But I can't understand one thing. Your cyanide cylinder, suppose I... Pull it out of your mouth. Rose, hold your breath until I close the valve. There. All right, Tolan. You realize what will happen to you if you don't answer the questions I'm going to ask you. Cyanide lack. It would be a most uncomfortable death. I'm only an Earthman. I can't appreciate its true horrors, but you can, can't you?
Drake, give him the cylinder. Give it back to him.
You have about 1 hour, I think, until the effects are irreversible. Talk quickly, Dr. Tolan, and you'll have your cyanide cylinder back.
What are your questions?
What are your theories concerning the inhibition death? Why did you really come to Earth? What is your interest in the Missing Persons Bureau?
For years, I have been investigating the cell structure of my patients suffering from inhibition death. I've been forced to use the utmost secrecy, since the methods I used were frowned on by my people. Your society would have similar feelings against human vivisection, for instance. For this reason, I could not present the results I obtained to my fellow physicians until I had verified my theories here on Earth.
And what are they?
The inhibition death is entirely... a disease of the mind.
You mean it's psychosomatic?
No, Miss Smollett, it is not psychosomatic. It is a true disease of the mind, a mental infection. My patients had double minds. Beyond and beneath the one that obviously belonged to them, there was evidence of another one, an alien mind. In short, there are not only 5 intelligences in the galaxy, but 6. And the 6th is parasitic.
This is impossible. You must be mistaken, Dr. Tolan.
No, I'm not mistaken. One can imagine such a parasite through the course of millions of years, perhaps losing all portions of its physical being. It would become nothing but pure mind, living in some mental fashion we cannot conceive of on the minds of others, particularly on the minds of Earthmen.
Why particularly Earthmen?
Have you not surmised that the 6th intelligence is a native of Earth? Mankind from the beginning has lived with it, has adapted to it, is unconscious of it. It is why the higher species of terrestrial animals, including man, do not grow after maturity and eventually die. And it is what is called natural death. It is the result of this universal parasitic infestation. where Earthmen could survive the infection for decades with little harm. We others die a quick death, within a year. Give me back my cylinder. You have your answer.
What about the Missing Persons Bureau?
Drake, look at his eyes. Give it back to him.
As we are not well adapted to the intelligence that infests man, neither is it well adapted to us. It can live on us, but it cannot reproduce, with ourselves alone as the source of its life. The inhibition death is therefore not directly contagious among our people.
What are you implying, Dr. Tolan?
The Earthman remains the prime host for the parasite, and an Earthman may infect one of us if he remains among us. But the parasite, once it is located in an intelligence of the outer worlds, must somehow return to an Earthman if it expects to reproduce. We are infected and reinfected as the parasites return to Earth and come back to us via the mind of Earthmen who travel through space.
And the missing persons?
Are the intermediate hosts. The masculine terrestrial mind seems better suited for their purpose. But once reproduction has been taken care of, the infested male leaves by spaceship for the outer worlds. He disappears.
But this is impossible. What you say implies that the parasite mind can control the actions of its host. That can't be, or we would have noticed their presence here on Earth.
The control may be very subtle, and may moreover be exerted only during the period of active reproduction. I simply point to your Missing Persons Bureau. Why do the young men disappear? I'm quite ill now, cyanide lack, and I cannot speak much longer.
And you alone, of all your people, have any knowledge of this theory of yours?
I alone. You will give me back my cyanide cylinder now. I have become quite weak.
Sure. Sure, Dr. Tolan.
Rose. No, no!
Rose, come out of here. Come on now. Come on.
He's dead, you shot him.
Outside. Out. Quiet, Rose, quiet. I told you to have nothing to do with this.
Let me go. I want to go away. I want to go away.
Why? Because of something it was my job to do? You heard what that creature was saying. You suppose I could allow him to return to his world and spread those lies? They'd believe him. What do you think would happen then? They would have to kill us all to stop that disease.
What he said wasn't a lie. It was true.
Oh, come on, now you're hysterical. You need sleep.
I know what he said was true because the Security Commission knows all about the same theory and knows it's true.
Why do you say a thing like that?
Because you let it slip yourself.
Now, sit down. Sit down. Well, so I gave myself away, did I? When?
You turned white when Hark Tolan referred to me as a charming hostess. Hostess has a double meaning, Drake. A host is one who harbors a parasite.
Well, I had no idea I was so transparent. Look, Rose, I've done my best to keep you out of this.
The truth can't be held down forever. Somebody else will find out. You can't kill them all.
We know that, too. We have no choice.
Why? Why can't we combine with the other intelligences and wipe out the parasite?
No, you don't understand. Hark Tolan was right. Man and his prehistoric ancestors have been living with this parasitic intelligence for uncounted ages. We've not only become adapted to it, we've become dependent on it. It is no longer a case of parasitism. It's a case of mutual cooperation. You biologists have a name for it.
What are you talking about? Symbiosis?
Yes, exactly. We have a disease of our own, remember? It is a reverse disease, one of unrestrained growth. You've mentioned it already as a contrast to inhibition death. It's all very well to say that if we could remove the parasite, we would have eternal growth in life, but it's impossible for us. If for any reason the parasitic intelligence, as Hark Tolan calls it, does leave the human body, or if its relationship to the human mind is in any way impaired, growth does take place, but not in an orderly fashion. We call the growth cancer, and there you have it. There's no way of getting rid of the parasite. We're together for all eternity. To get rid of their inhibition death, extraterrestrials must first wipe out all vertebrate life on Earth. There is no other solution for them. So we must keep knowledge of it from them. Now do you understand?
He got the body out of the apartment. I sat there numbly. He lied to me. Cancer could not be a disease that was an expression of lost ability for normal growth. Cancer attacked children while they were still growing. It could even attack embryonic tissue. Cancer had nothing to do with the presence or absence of normal growth. Its absence would not cause cancer. Drake lied, but no one would believe me. The young men who disappeared were usually in the first year of their marriage. Whatever the process of reproduction of the parasite intelligence was, it must involve close association with another parasite. The type of close and continuous association, as in the case of newly married couples. The parasite could control actions. I'd report them both, Drake Smollett and Hark Tolan, to the Missing Persons Bureau. But they'd never find them, for they'd be out in space. I wanted to weep, but I couldn't. I was dry-eyed, and it was painful. I'd looked for the answers to so many questions, and I'd found them all. I even found the answer to the question I thought had no bearing on the subject. I finally learned why Drake had married me.
I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.